Nobody had given anything away. The smooth wall of deception had as yet shown no real crack to his roaming fingers. When Rollo Martins left Dr. Winkler's, he was in no danger. He could have gone home to bed at Sacher's and slept with a quiet mind. He could even have visited Kula at this stage without trouble. No one was seriously disturbed. Unfortunately for him, and there would always be periods of his life when he bitterly regretted it, he chose to go back to Harry's flat. He wanted to talk to the little vexed man who said he had seen the accident. Or had he really not said so much? There was a moment in the dark, frozen streets when he was inclined to go straight to Kula to complete his picture of those sinister birds who sat around Harry's body. But Rollo, being Rollo, decided to toss a coin, and the coin fell for the other action, and the deaths of two men. Perhaps the little man, who bore the name of Koch, had drunk a glass too much of wine. Perhaps he had simply spent a good day at the office. But this time, when Rollo Martins rang his bell, he was friendly and quite ready to talk. He had just finished dinner and had crumbs on his moustache. "Ah, I remember you. You are Herr Lime's friend." He welcomed Martins in with great cordiality and introduced him to a mountainous wife whom he obviously kept under very strict control. "Ah, in the old days, I would have offered you a cup of coffee, but now..." Martins passed round his cigarette case, and the atmosphere of cordiality deepened. "When you came yesterday, I was a little abrupt," Herr Koch said, "but I had a touch of migraine, and my wife was out, so I had to answer the door myself."
"Did you tell me that you had actually seen the accident?"
Herr Koch exchanged glances with his wife.
"The inquest is over, Ilse. There is no harm. You can trust my judgment. The gentleman is a friend." "Yes, I saw the accident, but you are the only one who knows. When I say that I saw it, perhaps I should say that I heard it. I heard the brakes put on, and the sound of the skid, and I got to the window in time to see them carry the body to the house."
"But didn't you give evidence?"
"It is better not to be mixed up in such things. My office cannot spare me. We are short of staff. And, of course, I did not actually see,
but you told me yesterday how it happened."
"That was how they described it in the papers."
"Was he in great pain?"
"He was dead. I looked right down from my window here, and I saw his face. I know when a man is dead. You see, it is, in a way, my business. I am the head clerk at the mortuary."
"But the others say that he did not die at once."
"Perhaps they don't know death as well as I do.
He was dead, of course, when the doctor arrived. He told me that."
"He was dead at once. You can take the word of a man who knows."
"I think, Herr Koch, that you should have given evidence."
"One must look after oneself, Herr Martins. I was not the only one who should have been there."
"How do you mean?"
"There were three people who helped to carry your friend to the house."
"I know. Two men and the driver."
"The driver stayed where he was. He was very much shaken, poor man."
"Three men?" It was as though suddenly, fingering that bare wall, his fingers had encountered not so much a crack, perhaps, but at least a roughness that had not been smoothed away by the careful builders. "Can you describe the men?"
But Herr Koch was not trained to observe the living. Only the man with the toupee had attracted his eyes. The other two were just men, neither tall nor short, thick nor thin. He had seen them from far above, foreshortened, bent over their burden. They had not looked up, and he had quickly looked away and closed the window, realizing at once the wisdom of not being seen himself.
"There was no evidence I could really give, Herr Martins."
"No evidence," Martins thought. "No evidence." He no longer doubted that murder had been done. Why else had they lied about the moment of death? They wanted to quieten with their gifts of money and their plane ticket the only two friends Harry had in Vienna. And the third man? Who was he?
He said, "Did you see Herr Lime go out?"
"No."
"Did you hear a scream?"
"Only the brakes, Herr Martins."
It occurred to Martins that there was nothing except the word of Kurtz and Kula and the driver to prove that, in fact, Harry had been killed at that precise moment.
There was the medical evidence, but that could not prove more than that he had died, say, within a half hour. And in any case, the medical evidence was only as strong as Dr. Winkler's word. That clean, controlled man creaking among his crucifixes.
Herr Martins, it just occurs to me. You are staying in Vienna?
Yes.
If you need accommodation and spoke to the authorities quickly, you might secure Herr Leim's flat. It is a requisitioned property.
Who has the keys?
I have them.
Could I see the flat?
Ilse, the keys.
Herr Koch led the way into the flat that had been Harry's. In the little dark hall, there was still the smell of cigarette smoke, the Turkish cigarettes that Harry always smoked. It seemed odd that a man's smell should cling in the folds of a curtain so long after the man himself had become dead matter, a gas, a decay. One light in a heavily beaded shade left them in semi-darkness, fumbling for door handles. The living room was completely bare. It seemed to Martins too bare. The chairs had been pushed up against the walls. The desk at which Harry must have written was free from dust or any papers. The parquet reflected the light like a mirror. Herr Koch opened a door and showed the bedroom. The bed neatly made, with clean sheets. In the bathroom, not even a used razor blade indicated that a few days ago a living man had occupied it. Only the dark hall and the cigarette smell gave a sense of occupation.
"You see," Herr Koch said, "it is quite ready for a newcomer. Ilse has cleaned up."
That she certainly had done. After a death, there should have been more litter left than this. A man can't go suddenly and unexpectedly on his longest journey without forgetting this or that, without leaving a bill unpaid, an official form unanswered, the photograph of a girl.
"Were there no papers, Herr Koch?"
Herr Leim was always a very tidy man. His waste paper basket was full, and his briefcase, but his friend fetched that away.
His friend?
The gentleman with the toupee.
It was possible, of course, that Lyme had not taken the journey so unexpectedly. And it occurred to Martins that Lyme had perhaps hoped he would arrive in time to help. He said to Herr Koch, "I believe my friend was murdered."
"Murdered?"
Herr Koch's cordiality was snuffed out by the word. He said,
"I would not have asked you in here if I had thought you would talk such nonsense."
"Why should it be nonsense? We do not have murders in this zone." "All the same, your evidence may be very valuable."
"I have no evidence. I saw nothing." "I am not concerned. You must leave here at once, please. You have been very inconsiderate."
He hustled Martins back through the hall. Already the smell of the smoke was fading a little more. Herr Koch's last word before he slammed his own door was, "It's no concern of mine." Poor Herr Koch. We do not choose our concerns. Later, when I was questioning Martins closely, I said to him, "Did you see anybody at all on the stairs, or in the street outside?"
"Nobody."
He had everything to gain by remembering some chance passerby, and I believed him. He said, "I noticed myself how quiet and dead the whole street looked. Part of it had been bombed, you know, and the moon was shining on the snow slopes. It was so very silent. I could hear my own feet creaking in the snow." Of course, it proves nothing. There's a basement where anybody who had followed you could have hidden.
Yes.
Or your whole story may be phony.
Yes.
The trouble is, I can see no motive for you to have done it. It's true you're already guilty of getting money on false pretenses. You came out here to join Lyme, perhaps to help him.
Martins said to me, "What was this precious racket you keep on hinting at?
I'd have told you all the facts when I first saw you if you hadn't lost your temper so damn quickly. Now I don't think I shall be acting wisely to tell you. It would be disclosing official information, and your contacts, you know, don't inspire confidence. A girl with phony papers supplied by Lyme, this man Kurtz,
Dr. Winkler."
"I've got nothing against Dr. Winkler. No, if you are phony, you don't need the information, but it might help you to learn exactly what we know. You see, our facts are not complete."
"I bet they aren't.
I could invent a better detective than you in my bath. Your literary style does not do your namesake justice." Whenever he was reminded of Mr. Crabbin, that poor harassed representative of the British Council, Rollo Martins turned pink with annoyance, embarrassment, shame. That, too, inclined me to trust him. He had certainly given Krabbin some uncomfortable hours. On returning to Sacher's hotel after his interview with Herr Koch, he had found a desperate note waiting for him from the representative. "I have been trying to locate you all day," Krabbin wrote. "It is essential that we should get together and work out a proper program for you. This morning, by telephone, I have arranged lectures at Innsbruck and Salzburg for next week, but I must have your consent to the subjects so that proper programs can be printed. I would suggest two lectures, The Crisis of Faith in the Western World. You are very respected here as a Christian writer, but this lecture should be quite unpolitical, and no references should be made to Russia or communism. And The Technique of the Contemporary Novel. The same lectures will be given in Vienna. Apart from this, there are a great many people here who would like to meet you, and I want to arrange a cocktail party for early next week. But for all this, I must have a few words with you."
The letter ended on a note of acute anxiety.
"You will be at the discussion tomorrow night, won't you? We all expect you at 8:30, and needless to say, look forward to your coming. I will send transport to the hotel at 8:15 sharp."
Rollo Martins read the letter, and without bothering any further about Mr. Krabbin, went to bed. After two drinks, Rollo Martins' mind would always turn towards women, in a vague, sentimental, romantic way, as a sex in general. After three drinks, like a pilot who dives to find direction, he would begin to focus on one available girl. If he had not been offered a third drink by Kula, he would probably not have gone quite so soon to Anna Schmidt's house. And if... But there are too many ifs in my style of writing, for it is my profession to balance possibilities, human possibilities, and the drive of destiny can never find a place in my files. Martins had spent his lunchtime reading up the reports of the inquest, thus again demonstrating the superiority of the amateur to the professional, and making him more vulnerable to Kula's liquor, which the professional, in duty bound, would have refused. It was nearly 5 o'clock when he reached Kula's flat, which was over an ice cream parlour in the American zone. The bar below was full of GIs with their girls, and the clatter of the long spoons and the curious, free, unformed laughter followed him up the stairs. The Englishman who objects to Americans in general usually carries in his mind's eye just such an exception as Kula. A man with tousled grey hair and a worried, kindly face and long-sighted eyes. The kind of humanitarian who turns up in a typhus epidemic or a world war or a Chinese famine long before his countrymen have discovered the place in an atlas. Again, the card marked Harry's friend was like an entrance ticket. Kula was in officer's uniform with mysterious letters on his flash and no badges of rank, although his maid referred to him as Colonel Kula. His warm, frank handclasp was the most friendly act that Martins had encountered in Vienna. "Any friend of Harry is all right with me," Kula said. "I've heard of you, of course."
"From Harry?"
"I'm a great reader of Westerns," Kula said, and Martins believed him as he did not believe Kurtz. "I wondered, you were there, weren't you, if you'd tell me about Harry's death." "It was a terrible thing," Kula said. "I was just crossing the road to go to Harry. He and Mr. Kurtz were on the sidewalk. Maybe if I hadn't started across the road, he'd have stayed where he was. But he saw me and stepped straight off to meet me. And this jeep, it was terrible, terrible. The driver braked, but he didn't stand a chance. Have a scotch, Mr. Martins. It's silly of me, but I get shaken up when I think of it." He said, as he splashed in the soda, "In spite of this uniform, I'd never seen a man killed before." "Was the other man in the car?" Kula took a long pull, and then measured what was left with his tired, kindly eyes. "What man would you be referring to, Mr. Martins?" "I was told there was another man there." "Well, I don't know how you got that idea. You'll find all about it in the inquest reports." He poured out two more generous drinks. "There were just the three of us, me and Mr. Kurtz, and the driver. The doctor, of course. I expect you were thinking of the doctor. This man I was talking to happened to look out of a window. He has the next flat to Harry's. And he said he saw three men and the driver. That's before the doctor arrived." "He didn't say that in court." "He didn't want to get involved." "You'll never teach these Europeans to be good citizens. It was his duty."
Cooler brooded sadly over his glass.
It's an odd thing, Mr. Martins, with accidents. You'll never get two reports that coincide. Why, even Mr. Kurtz and I disagreed about details. The thing happens so suddenly, you aren't concerned to notice things until bang, crash, and then you have to reconstruct. Remember. I expect he got too tangled up trying to sort out what happened before and what after to distinguish the four of us.
The four?
I was counting Harry. What else did he see, Mr. Martins?
Nothing of interest, except he says Harry was dead when he was carried to the house.
Well, he was dying. Not much difference there. Have another drink, Mr. Martins?
No, I don't think I will.
Well, I'd like another spot. I was very fond of your friend, Mr. Martins, and I don't like talking about it.
Well, perhaps one more, to keep you company.
Do you know Anna Schmidt?
Martins asked, while the whiskey tingled on his tongue.
Harry's girl.
I met her once, that's all. As a matter of fact, I helped Harry fix her papers. Not the sort of thing I should confess to a stranger, I suppose, but you have to break the rules sometimes. Humanity's a duty, too.
What was wrong?
She was Hungarian, and her father had been a Nazi, so they said. She was scared the Russians would pick her up.
Why should they want to?
Well, we can't always figure out why they do these things. Perhaps just to show that it's not healthy being friends with an Englishman.
But she lives in the British zone.
Well, that wouldn't stop them. It's only 5 minutes' ride in a jeep from the Kommandantur. The streets aren't well lighted, and you haven't many police around.
You took her some money from Harry, didn't you?
Yes, but I wouldn't have mentioned that. Did she tell you?
The telephone rang, and Cooler drained his glass.
Hello, he said. Why, yes, this is Colonel Cooler.
Then he sat with the receiver at his ear, and an expression of sad patience, while some voice a long way off drained into the room.
Yes, he said once.
Yes.
His eyes dwelt on Martin's face, but they seemed to be looking a long way beyond him. Flat and tired and kind, they might have been gazing out across the sea.
He said, "You did quite right," in a tone of commendation, and then, with a touch of asperity, "Of course they will be delivered. I gave my word. Goodbye."
He put the receiver down and passed a hand across his forehead wearily. It was as though he were trying to remember something he had to do.
Martin said, "Had you heard anything of this racket the police talk about?"
"I'm sorry. What's that?"
"Well, they say Harry was mixed up in some racket."
"Oh, no," Cooler said. "No, that's quite impossible. He had a great sense of duty."
"Kurtz seemed to think it was possible."
"Kurtz doesn't understand how an Anglo-Saxon feels,"
Cooler replied.
It was nearly dark when Martins made his way along the banks of the canal. Across the water lay the half-destroyed Diana Baths, and in the distance the great black circle of the Prater Wheel, stationary above the ruined houses. Over there, across the grey water, was the second Bezirk, in Russian ownership. St. Stephen's Kirk shot its enormous wounded spire into the sky above the inner city, and coming up the Kärntnerstrasse, Martins passed the lit door of the military police station. The four men of the International Patrol were climbing into their jeep. The Russian MP sat beside the driver, for the Russians had that day taken over the chair for the next 4 weeks, and the Englishman, the Frenchman, and the American mounted behind. The third stiff whiskey fumed into Martin's brain, and he remembered the girl in Amsterdam, the girl in Paris. Loneliness moved along the crowded pavement at his side. He passed the corner of the street where Sachers lay, and went on. Rollo was in control, and moved towards the only girl he knew in Vienna. I asked him how he knew where she lived. "Oh," he said, "he'd looked up the address she'd given him the night before, in bed studying a map. He wanted to know his way about, and he was good with maps. He could memorize turnings and street names easily, because he always went one way on foot."
"One way?"
"I mean, when I'm calling on a girl, or someone." He hadn't, of course, known that she would be in, that her play was not on that night in the Josefstadt, or perhaps he had memorized that, too, from the posters. In, at any rate, she was. if you could really call it being in, sitting alone in an unheated room, with the bed disguised as a divan, and a typewritten script lying open at the first page, on the inadequate, too-fancy, top-lid table, because her thoughts were so far from being in. He said, awkwardly, and nobody could have said, not even Rollo, how much his awkwardness